Hi, I'm Kathy Forstey, music director at KC Cafe Radio. David Hankin has been an icon in the Kansas City music scene for the last several decades. With the voice of John Denver, the wit of John Prine, and the poetry of Leonard Cohen, David has recorded 8 albums, and on his newest album, Stone and Steel, his writing and playing reaches new heights. Thanks, David, for joining us today on KC Cafe Radio.
Thanks, Kathy.
I've known you a really long time, but so this is kind of strange to just have a little conversation on the radio. But I wanted to talk to you about your new CD, which is just fabulous, Stone and Steel. Tell me a little bit about the album cover and where that photo was taken.
I decided that since the title track, Stone and Steel, is about late night at the Gallery District downtown, their first Friday extravaganza, that I should do the photo shoot down by those art galleries in the old industrial district downtown. So this alley goes behind several of those buildings, and it's called the Art Alley because it has graffiti on both sides, the whole block, all the way from 18th to 17th Street on both sides of the alley. So that's where I am, is by an old industrial building in the alley in front of a garage door.
Very cool. Was it done during First Fridays, or was it just...
No, we just picked an evening where people could come out and kind of sit around as if I'm busking in the alley.
Very cool. You talk a lot about Kansas City in your music, and you write a lot about Kansas City. You're originally from Kansas City, is that right?
Yes, grew up in Kansas City.
What part of the city did you grow up in?
The Brookside area, south of UMKC.
Uh-huh. And which school did you go to?
The elementary school was Border Star.
And you also, which high school was it?
At Southwest. Uh-huh. So right in that Brookside area.
Very cool. So was your family musical too?
My mom was always singing and listening to a real wide variety of music. You never knew if you were going to get opera or Love and Spoonful or something in between.
Yeah, that's awesome. Your mom play instruments, or your dad play instruments?
She played piano and pretty much would pull out sheet music and play a few piano pieces. And we had a piano in the house. And so I tried playing piano, and I can still do a little bit, but had trouble learning to read music on piano.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked to other guitar players who like, it's, as well as myself, it's piano is just something that kind of escapes us. You know, I took piano for like 3 years in college, and I still am a terrible piano player. But, you know, guitar, I just picked it up right away, and it was like part of me, you know?
So. Yeah.
I don't know what that is about us guitar players and piano, but we seem to have a block with it sometimes. Did you have any siblings that played as well? Or?
Yes, I had two older brothers that were playing guitar and singing, and we would cover Peter, Paul, and Mary songs. And before my voice changed as the younger brother, I would often take the high harmony part that they couldn't reach and still have the ability to go up higher into a head voice and find those harmonies. It's like they're hardwired somewhere.
Yeah. You do harmonies really, really well. So that's been ingrained in you from your childhood then.
Yeah, I can't tell someone how to do it. I just see the harmonies there and pick which one.
Yeah, you hear it in your head, I guess.
Yeah.
So what kind of music in your background contributed to the kind of musician you are today?
Well, I was listening to a lot of the stuff that my older brother was listening to. So even at 8, I was starting to listen to Peter, Paul, and Mary and the different songwriters that were starting to become well-known then, Paul Simon and James Taylor and Joni Mitchell, and actually wrote a song when I was 8 years old because I didn't know I wasn't supposed to, and was learning to fingerpick guitar around that time as well.
Wow. So you started really early.
Yeah.
What kind of guitar did you have at 8 years old?
I started for the first year on a ukulele. Uh-huh. that was tuned like the first four strings of a guitar. Mm-hmm. And it actually was a ukulele that my oldest brother, Chris, had made in high school wood shop. And to this day, I can't believe I let that ukulele go. I wish I still had it.
Wow, that is awesome. So it was tuned like a tenor guitar then?
Yeah.
Basically, yeah, that's very cool. If you are listening to the folk music of the time, so you think that was the major influences to what led to your sound today? I mean, do you consider your sound reminiscent of that?
I think a lot of my music is. Another big influence later was Bob Dylan and Jackson Brown, Eric Anderson, some of the people that were doing more folk rock.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have probably as many up-tempo songs as I have quiet finger-picking songs.
Mm-hmm.
And those are basically acoustic folk rock, where they're not really dance music, they're not really, you know, the boy-girl typical rock lyrics, but more like a folk rock ballads that are set to a rock and roll tempo.
Yeah, and you write a lot more socially active songs. You write a lot of music about Kansas City, about places in Kansas City and people in Kansas City. So there's not a lot of love songs in your music. Do you tend to not want to write love songs, or is it just you just write about what you feel around you?
Yeah, I think as, you know, someone that's pretty solidly in the contemporary folk genre, I end up thinking of myself as a folk singer.
Mm-hmm.
And a little out of place here in 2016 as a folk singer. If you try to Google that, almost all the major artists are ones that were famous in the 70s.
Yeah.
Late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You get compared to, mostly I guess because of your voice, to John Denver. Is that a comparison that you like?
Oh, yeah. I've always been a big fan of his vocals. Also, Peter Yarrow's.
Uh-huh.
I think when I was first learning to sing, when I was happy with my voice, it was sounding like Peter Yarrow, who just has this amazing range. He can do the low parts, some of the very high harmony with Peter, Paul, and Mary. Peter would get notes that were too high for Mary to reach.
Really?
Yes.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, Mary actually had a lower voice, too.
Mm-hmm.
She had a very low tone in her voice. So, yeah, I can see that. That's what made them so unique, is that the woman wasn't necessarily singing the high part every time, you know.
And when I started thinking about, well, I need to learn to sing, my mom gave me a few lessons in terms of how to breathe right. And I also spent a lot of time listening to Barbara Streisand and some of the other singers that were famous at that time.
Was there any, like, people in Kansas City at that time that you were going out and hearing and that influenced you?
My older brothers were out listening to music during the first round of coffee houses. By the time I got back from college, the very last one that was still around, the Crook of His Arm Coffee House, only stayed open a few weeks, and then it was gone.
What was the first place you performed at in Kansas City? I'm testing your memory.
Yeah, because they closed before I got my show there, and I probably didn't play out much until Whistler's Mother, which was a coffee house on top of Whistler's Books. It used to be on Westport Road.
Oh, cool. I guess you've seen Kansas City change a lot as far as the music scene over the years.
Yeah, especially having kept the Songwriter Circle in a monthly venue since 1992. We have seen a lot of cafes and coffee houses come and go.
Right. Was there much of a rock scene that you were into at that time, or was it just mostly folk music?
Mostly acoustic, even though I was listening to a lot of performers that were performing with a rock band. A lot of them were still using acoustic guitar in the mix, or writing and performing on acoustic guitar with a drum and bass and organ or synth.
Kansas City's known mostly for jazz music, but would you say that folk music is also a large influence in Kansas City as well?
I think so. There's always been a large support group for acoustic and bluegrass musicians in this town. And I think part of that is the long-running Walnut Valley Music Festival that started out being known for bluegrass and now has a little broader reach than that, but still has primarily acoustic instruments on all of the main stages.
Where is that festival for our listeners?
That is in Winfield, Kansas, close to Wichita.
Right. And that's something you've been to how many years now? How many years have you been there?
Oh, probably about 10 total. I went when my daughter was very young, about 2 or 3 years old. Recently, I would go down for the New Song Showcase once they got that started. I have been down on the winter stage about 4 times, and I'm helping now each year with a campground stage, Stage 11, which is for original music only, an official stage in the campground.
You've been such a big champion of local singer-songwriters. I mean, you've helped me find gigs and helped me and given me advice on. Why do you do that? Why do you want to help other singer-songwriters in Kansas City? I mean, basically, we're each other's competition when it comes down to it. But, I mean, you started the Songwriter Circle, back in 92, is that right?
Yes.
And why do you reach out to other songwriters and help them?
Well, one reason is pretty selfish. I just wanted to be able to be around people I respected as songwriters and be able to get help with my own music. Because I knew that I was putting together songs that were almost finished and really needed another set of ears to listen to them and help me get it polished to where it was really worth playing out. But the other thing that you have to realize at the time in 92 was that there weren't many venues willing to have a solo performer or a songwriter perform. And there were a lot of people out there that had really good stuff, that knew how to perform and sing and play guitar. And there were very few opportunities. So it was pretty cutthroat. Someone had an arrangement with a bar that had a stage, and they were there on Thursday nights. Even if, you know, you talk to someone about booking several months out and nobody was booked on that Thursday night, I once got a show booked, and then they called me back and said, oh, well, you know, our usual performer on Thursday night complained, and so we're going to let him do that Thursday night, even though I had a confirmed booking. It was really bad. Yeah. And other songwriters were definitely the competition. And so what we were able to do with Songwriter Circle is convince people to cooperate to help each other get noticed. Instead, you'd have a scenario where I went to a coffee house once where I'd gotten a booking and was able to get a crowd in, and they were really enjoying it, and Leslie Revelle was there. Mm-hmm. And so I invite her up on stage, have her sing harmony on a couple of songs, and I ask the audience, do you want to hear one of Leslie's songs? And they say yes, and they're clapping, and she does a couple of her songs. And so I go up to the mic and say, would you like Leslie to come back for her own show? And of course, they're clapping and cheering and everything. Mm-hmm. Well, she gets off the stage, and the person who owns the coffee house who's doing the booking is right there behind the counter. And it's a no-brainer. She doesn't need to give him a CD. He has everything he needs to know. All they need to do is set a date. Mm-hmm. She's in.
Right.
And so we started doing that for each other and sharing shows when we were able to get bookings. All of a sudden, there are a lot of places to play. And I'm not sure how this happened, except that I know that more people were trying to do music as a business in Kansas City and started to ask to get paid. And there were more people who appreciated the singer-songwriter music because people were spending the time to really work on their songs and work on their performance and do really good shows of original music. And so you had a core of promoters that decided, you know, we're getting advertising from their mailing list, they're getting people in that wouldn't have come here otherwise, we're going to pay at least a little. And this became the norm. And now people expect to have to pay if they're going to get people that are worth listening to. And so right now, you know, Larry Garrett has a newsletter, and there are just within that part of the songwriting community, 2 or 3 singer-songwriters outperforming and usually getting paid 2 or 3 on Friday and 2 or 3 on Saturday every single week.
Yeah. You know, we've got a really great group of people here in Kansas City that there are singer-songwriters that are pretty regularly playing every weekend someplace, and it's nice that we can do that here. Speaking of which, you recently retired from your job. Tell people what you did before you're doing music full-time.
Well, I've been teaching second grade, mm-hmm. and after 28 years, I decided I was close enough to go ahead and get the retirement from the district and go full-time music. And I'm doing a little bit of film editing, a little bit of studio audio recording, music recording. But I'm trying to, as much as I can, get out regionally and get bookings to doing a full-time touring musician.
Yeah, and you're going out basically every once in a while to places outside Missouri and Kansas. And
yes.
You were recently in Utah.
Yeah, it was a great tour in Utah and Colorado. And it's kind of hard to set that up while I was still teaching, but was real fortunate to find a lot of people to help me out, and I ended up actually making a little money, even with the expenses of 2,700 miles.
You have a van or a car? What are you touring in?
Well, I've got a station wagon, which is just enough for me going solo.
And are you doing mostly house concerts, or what kind of venues are you playing?
Or playing at restaurants that have live music.
And how are you finding those venues?
Well, I'm using the internet, but I'm also talking to other performers and looking at other performers' tour dates, mm-hmm. and looking for opportunities that make sense, because I'm not going to be able to bring in a big crowd and a lot of places that really want a particular style of music, like a blues band. You know, I don't bother them. I look for places that typically in the past have had solo singer-songwriters perform.
Mm-hmm. Also, you went to Australia. Tell people how you got that gig.
Well, I've been asked to come out and do the Phoenix Folk Festival. It's actually Glendale Folk Festival by Barb Jamalvo. And we had talked, but I'd never been out there. I do have it on my schedule for next March, 2017. I already have that booked, which is part of the problem of, you know, booking a tour, is you've got to think so far ahead. But she been doing travel for a long, long time as her day job. And so she started doing cruises. And she did a cruise down to Australia, and she talked to the people there, because she was there during the Illawarra Folk Festival, which is one of the big regional festivals about an hour south of the big city. And they said, yeah, we're not a big national festival that can afford to bring in a lot of international performers, but we would love to have people come down from the United States, and we'll put them up here and feed them, and, you know, if they can get the ticket down. So she said, well, I can find you really good people from the United States that would love to come down to play at the festival. So she asked me, you know, I had to think of it as both maybe a once-in-a-lifetime chance to see Australia as a vacation, and also as a chance to build an audience in Australia and play on the main stage of the festival. Mm-hmm. So I went down and played a couple of shows in Sydney the week before, and then had several festival spots on the stages at the festival.
That's awesome.
Yep. Great experience. Great people down there. They, you know, put me up and fed me and drove me all around, and just love being in Australia.
Yeah, I'd love to go there myself. That's my dream place to go. So where did you play in Canada when you were up there?
Played in Toronto. Sister-in-law was good enough to help me set up a place in kind of the touristy part, refurbished old buildings and good places to eat in downtown Toronto. That was a lot of fun. Did a solo show there as kind of part of a trip up to see them.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Leslie Revell a little bit earlier. You have a duo with her called Street Corner Choir.
Yes, got a couple of CDs out and have kind of gone into a hiatus as I'm trying the next couple of years to really be playing farther afield rather than just regionally.
And Leslie's very busy with things as well. She's got a full
life. Yes, her playwriting has really taken off, and she's got people that are wanting to produce her plays, and she's won a couple of playwriting awards, and she's starting a novel, and just really busy on the creative front on some other things right now.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, though, between Street Corner Choir and your solo stuff, how do you decide what is a Street Corner Choir song and what is a David Hankins song?
Well, that's pretty easy because some of the old folk ballads don't even have a chorus. And I have a lot of songs that don't have any chorus at all. So the songs that have a big singable chorus for both of our repertoires would end up on the Street Corner Choir CDs because it was so much fun being able to have a harmony on those choruses.
You just mentioned some of your songs don't have choruses. How do you write a song, and how often do you write?
I have been writing a song a month or more each month since 1992 with the Songwriters Circle. New song night coming every third Friday. I'm putting the challenge out there for someone to bring a new song at least once a month, which means I have to have a new song once a month, every month of the year. So that has kept me writing. I'm doing more writing now that I'm retired from teaching and just had a couple of new songs over the 4th of July weekend. But I was thinking about that question because my music varies so much in terms of whether it's quiet finger picking or rock and roll backbeat, up tempo. And I thought I would take a look at some of the songs on Stone and Steel and kind of give a feel for how those happened. Like most of my projects, the songs are coming from all kinds of different places. The first one, Your Business Dollars, is the title, was from going by a construction zone. They really could have left one lane open, but it was one of those projects where they had tons of money and they had this great big crew and they just totally blocked off the entire street and were just putting something really fancy up really fast. And someone turned to me and said, "Your business dollars at work." Play off your tax dollars at work.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's too good. I have to write a song on that. And so that came from the title and the hook. Mm-hmm. And that's one way that I sometimes will get into songs is have something that's like that, that's just a slight twist. The other song on the project that was like that was Live and Not Learn. You know, I was sitting with a friend and we were at a hotel and somebody was carrying a tray with a lot of stuff on it. And you know, they've done this every day for years. And they piled too much on the tray. Mm-hmm. And they knew it was too much, and they did it anyway, and sure enough, the whole tray ended up going. Turns to me and says, "Live and not learn."
Yeah.
It's like, you know. So that sometimes can be the start, and that will get some lyrics to fit that title and a feel for what the music's going to be to support it. Where the Hippies Go, I actually was at a Dana Cooper concert, and he did a song about his college days. And I just thought, you know, I've never even tried to write a song about my college days. So I decided to borrow the music, since it's a song about that era, from Bob Dylan's Desolation Row. Because I have kind of I've worked that up as a cover with kind of my own twist on the music and my own harmonica part for it. So I did some changes. And kind of the very beginning is kind of an homage to Dylan. If you really know that song, you think I'm going to be going right into Desolation Row, but I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I took a real life experience, which was taking a cab ride to visit this college and having the cabbie saying, "Oh, well, you definitely don't want to go to that college because that's where all the hippies go." Well, at that time, I'm a straight A student and, you know, clean cut. And you know, he was warning me off, which of course didn't do any good.
I think you'd be attracted to that more than you'd be not attracted to it.
Exactly. I mean, it was a totally wrong thing to say. And I just fell in love with the college when I visited it. And so that was an easy song to write. That's like the cabin where I just take, you know, all of those personal experiences and pick the ones that fit with the rhymes and fit with the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of my song to set the record straight, because I realize that a lot of young people growing up now have very fuzzy, inaccurate view of that time period, because I was going to college between 70 and 73.
Mm-hmm.
The other song, The Fire Warden, I often will read a book. This was actually a historical novel I get an idea from something I've read, especially looking back at history, and realize, you know, there's a great story here that I had no idea about, that if I, you know, grew up not really knowing those what happened during the Blitz in London, I'll bet a lot of other people in this country have no clue either, and decided, you know, this is a story that needs to be told. So tried to do a little additional research to make sure it was pretty factual, and ended up writing about the Blitz in London from the firefighters' point of view.
That's one of my favorite songs on the CD. How about Solid Gollin? How was that one written?
That one, the music came first. I had been using partial capo when I started using them, when I found that it actually made things easier, not harder, to play on guitar. Because anything that makes the guitar easier, I'm all for. I don't spend a lot of time practicing guitar, though I'm doing more of that these days. And one of the tunings that I like the most is from the three-string partial capo that gives me what I call the E-gad tuning. It's kind of like dab-gad, only it's actually an E. So I had come up with kind of another music based on that that was really danceable. And I usually don't do that kind of music. And ended up writing a song about death and thinking about, is there a positive way to look at this and not just make it sour grapes or whiny? And as I was writing it lyrically, the phrase Solid Gone came up, and it's one from listening to Tom Rush do a lot of traditional blues and folk blues and Delta blues. I always loved his rendition of Solid Gone, even though I wasn't really sure what Solid Gone meant. It just had that emotional connection that was so right. I use that as my phrase of, I'm going to be dead and gone.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's very cool. That's one of my favorites on the CD as well. I like that one a lot too. So where did you record this CD?
I recorded it at Big Time Music, which is Steve Phillips' studio. He's lead guitarist for the Elders and the Rainmakers. I had started my first CD in Midtown at his studio. And, you know, I've done a few projects with him and done some home recording projects when I just didn't have the money. And I decided to go back and really spend the money to get this a fully produced CD that would compete better with the CDs that had the backing of Red House Records or Signature Records, mm-hmm. Some of the record companies that are doing this kind of music. I love working with Steve because he not only does a great job with the recording and mixing, but he's a really good producer and helps me decide what arrangement is going to be best for the songs. Mm-hmm. And he also can pick up anything with strings and do a fabulous guitar part. I really had thought that I would love to have an electric slide guitar on Land of Stone and Steel, a title cut. So even though, you know, I keep saying folk rock instead of rock and actually don't own an electric guitar, I'm sitting there playing the rhythm guitar part to this song, and Steve says, it's really sounding good, but I wonder how it would sound on this. And he hands me a 1963 Silvertone archtop electric guitar. Mm. And so I ended up playing the rhythm guitar part on that. And he uses a Telecaster and does the fabulous electric slide guitar solo throughout.
Yeah, he's amazing. We recorded my second album there with my band Swink, and he did banjo on one of our yeah. tunes, and he's just incredible.
Yeah,
he has such a good
mandolin.
Ear.
He gets that kind of music. He's the place in town that Brewer and Chipley record when they come up from Springfield. It's just really fabulous.
But you're venturing into the recording studio genre yourself. I just talked to Larry Garrett the other day, and he said he was recording at your studio. You think your next CD is going to be recorded at your own studio then?
That I don't know. What I can do real well is mainly just vocal guitar and putting some extra stuff on it. I don't have the square footage to really handle a full-blown project with lots of people playing at the same time. Mm-hmm. But what happened was that I found I needed a new computer, and I'd been doing some of the pro programs and freelancing. And I could either have the money to go into the studio, or I could put that money into a new computer with the pro software and learn it. Mm-hmm. And that's how the Storm CD came about. You know, the good thing was that I learned how to do the mixing and mastering, which a lot of people are spending way too much money on. Learned how to do not only the mixing and recording, but also the mastering of a project. And was able to do that without paying for any studio time. But the bad part was that I didn't do any songwriting that whole 11 months. Mm. It took me to really get in and learn everything on my own. I remember spending about 40 hours a whole week just really learning what compression was all about and how I wanted to use it on my project.
Wow, that's dedication.
So, you know, it was really good to do that, and right. You know, happy with how the Storm CD came out. And I can use that now. I mean, I'm getting some recording done for entering for the song contest. And I can get a really good vocal guitar recording really fast because I've got all the presets from doing finished projects. And I can just pull that up, you know, one I used on this CD or that song or that person, and very quickly now have it sounding really, really good.
So are you, like, willing to take people in and have them record at your studio? And
oh, yeah. When I'm in town, that's the whole plan, is that when I'm not on tour, to be able to have something to bring some money in, because paychecks are stopping from the school district.
Right. So tell people where your studio is located.
59th and Charlotte, right off of Rock Hill, just south of UMKC. You know, it's a really good option for someone, especially singer-songwriter, just wanting a really good vocal guitar. If that's the way they perform and people want to hear it, just like the performance, I can do a really good job on that and master it, which saves several hundred dollars.
Great. I hope people listening will, you know, hear this and come by and work with you, because David does great work. I know Larry loves what you did for his music this last week he was in there, I think.
Yeah, that's been fun.
So this is a question I like to ask every songwriter. I'm curious to hear what your answer is. What's your favorite song of all time and why?
Well, it's funny because one of my songwriting workshops has people take their 10 favorite songs and rank order them. You know, the 10 greatest songs that they know about. And it's extremely difficult. When I have done that, Joni Mitchell's Judgment of the Moon and Stars, Ludwig's tune, I think she calls it, about Beethoven, is still up there as number one.
What is it about that song that makes you love it so much?
She does so much with so few lyrics. She'll just have a phrase with three words in it that most people would put in a whole line. She's able to tell that story with so much emotion and everything that you need for the background with, again, a lot of economy of words. Her track on her CD has a whole lot of instrumental stuff, which kind of you would expect with a song about Beethoven. But actually, if you look at the lyrics, they're very sparse, but very, very powerful. And stay with you. There are parts of that song that you can kind of take and put in your pocket and pull out and, you know, have as a guide for life.
Yeah. There's nobody else that writes like Joni Mitchell. She's one of a kind. So can we expect more music to be released? Are you more concentrating on your touring right now? What is in your future plans?
Well, actually, I have enough new songs that are good enough to go on a CD to put out an entire CD right now. And so my plan now, besides really trying to stay organized and be more self-employed, working at my new business, Haken Studios, LLC, than summer vacation, which is what I'm used to. Just goofing off in the summer after your teaching. And I've earned some of that, but I need to get really organized. Mm-hmm. So my plan is to really get all of the booking under my belt for at least 9 to 12 months, and then start trying to build a band, a duo or trio. I'm looking for a fiddle player, looking for someone that can play accordion or keyboard, people that could sing harmony. Other songwriters would be great, but you know, someone that could do hand percussion and really take these up-tempo songs and have a band version of them.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great. So it would be the David Henken Band, or have you got...
Probably. I think I want to have people that are willing to tour and able to tour. I'm going to North Carolina in November, and I'm going to Phoenix, Arizona via San Francisco in March, and would love to get to Europe next summer. Mm-hmm. It's either going to have to be somebody young enough that they don't have ties, or somebody retired and ready to hit the road.
Right.
I don't know what this band's going to look like.
Yeah, that's exciting. Well, I want to let everybody know they can find out more about David Henken at www.davidhenken.com. That's David and Hakan.com. You can also find David on Facebook. And then his music is available at CD Baby, iTunes, Amazon. And he's got some really good videos on YouTube as well.
Yeah, and Bandcamp is really the place I'm sending people that are interested, because you can hear the entire song. I think they only cut you off after you've heard the entire song three times, and then they give you a little pop-up reminder, are you interested in buying this? But you can just hear all of the songs, because a lot of the story songs, you know, 20 seconds is not going to give you the feel for...
Yeah, I agree.
...song, and you listen to the whole songs from all 8 CDs there.
Great, yeah, and you have 8 CDs, so that there's a lot of music to take in and to hear, and every single one of the CDs are great, and David is a great singer-songwriter and writer. And like I said, he's a great champion of singer-songwriters here in Kansas City, so it's always good to support you as well as all the support you give all of us, so we appreciate that.
Well, thanks so much for doing this interview.
Sure, thank you. And one more time, davidhenken.com and Facebook, and find him on Bandcamp. All right, thank you, David, and we'll be chatting soon.
Okay, thanks. Bye.